You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. We've got the enemy right where we want them. They're all around us. Part 2. Interior Lines in Military History and the Martial Arts. Today I continue my three-part series on the military concept of interior lines. This is when the military commander is able to use the fact that he is surrounded by the enemy, at least somewhat to his advantage. I'm going to describe a battle that I think is perhaps the finest example in history of this concept. It happened in 1879 in southern Africa at a place called Rorke's Drift. The battle was between 150 British soldiers and 4,000 Zulu warriors. Let's set up a little background first. About 60 years before this, just a little after the Napoleonic Wars, a Zulu named Shaka revolutionized tribal warfare in southern Africa. Up to this point, conflict between tribes usually consisted of two small forces meeting to exchange shouted insults, throw a few spears, maybe have some battles between champions. But after that, there was very seldom any hand-to-hand combat, and almost never seriously pitched battles. Shaka came along and changed all that. After seizing chieftainship of the Zulus, he began his military revolution. He changed the armament, tactics, and training of Zulu warriors. He adopted a modified form of the assegai, the traditional spear. The new weapon was something much closer to a sword than to a spear. It was a 2-foot wooden handle with a wicked 1-foot-long leaf-shaped blade at the end. This new weapon was called, and I'm sure I'll butcher this pronunciation, the ikhlwa, and was reported to be named for the sound the blade made when it entered or was pulled out of a body. Yeah, I know, right? He also modified the traditional cowhide shield, making it larger and more stout. The warriors still carried the old throwing spears that they had once used. But after throwing them at the beginning of the battle, they would now routinely close in with the enemy using the shield and short stabbing spear. Aside from not wearing armor, this is remarkably similar to the infantry tactics used by the Romans of the classical era. Shaka also subjected his troops to intense training for both fighting skills and mobility. It was reputed that Zulu warriors could run 50 miles in a day, and then fight a full-scale battle. Whether this is actually true is the subject of debate among historians, but it is clear that Shaka rapidly transformed a small, primitive tribal force into a fast, flexible, and deadly army of conquest. He also introduced battle tactics to the Zulus, most especially a double encirclement battle plan called the Bull's Horns. This was a sophisticated set of battle tactics that he seemed to have come up with on his own. When Shaka took over the Zulus, they were a much smaller tribe than they would eventually become under his leadership. He added other tribes to his confederation through conquest, using his new military tactics, as well as a highly developed set of diplomatic skills. Now, Shaka was aware of gunpowder technology, but he had little respect for the slow loading and firing process of the muzzle-loading muskets of that day. With that bit of background out of the way, let's move forward in time to 1879. The area now controlled by the Zulus, ruled by Shaka's half-nephew, Cetshwayo, had become quite large. Large enough that the British, who already ruled adjacent areas, thought that adding the Zulu kingdom to their lands would nicely round out the map of southern Africa. A representative of the British government issued an ultimatum to the Zulus. disband your armies and mend your primitive heathen ways so that they're more like ours, or we'll invade and do it for you. I would imagine that the Zulu response to this ultimatum consisted of two words. In any case, in January of 1879, a British military force crossed the Buffalo River into Zulu territory. It was divided into three separate columns. The center column set up camp without any entrenchment or defensive works. This was because the British commander had no respect or fear of native African military capabilities. The Zulus soon changed his mind. They appeared, seemingly out of nowhere, and attacked the camp with six times the numbers of the British, who were taken totally by surprise. The Zulus killed 1,300 of the 1,800 soldiers, capturing two artillery pieces and more than 1,000 rifles. This debacle went down in history as the Battle of Isandlwana, and was the worst defeat of a British force in all of its many colonial wars. Coincidentally, and in stark contrast, that same day, a mere 6 miles away, a small group of British soldiers accomplished one of the most amazing feats in all of military history. This was the Battle of Rorke's Drift. The Zulus hadn't even used their entire complement of troops at Isandlwana. They had, as was their practice, held back 4,000 of their 20,000 as a reserve. After the battle, this fresh reserve force was sent to the border of English territory to cut off the retreat of any British survivors. At the border crossing, there was a small outpost of British troops. It was a supply depot and field hospital, garrisoned by about 250 men. This was not a single cohesive unit. Instead, it was a mixture of frontline infantry, native cavalry, engineers, supply clerks, hospital staff, and hospital patients. The ranking officer was a lowly lieutenant of engineers named John Chard. At about noon, Lieutenant Chard was informed by fleeing survivors of the disaster at Isandlwana, and even more horrifying, of the 4,000 Zulu warriors that were headed straight for the outpost, an outpost of which he was suddenly and unexpectedly in command. The decision was made that retreat was impossible without abandoning the patients in the field hospital. Chard, a practical military engineer, ordered his soldiers to begin fortifying the outpost. This was accomplished by filling burlap bags with corn, something which the supply outpost had tons of, and stacking the bags to make a 9-foot wall around the compound, incorporating the two buildings there as part of the ramparts. The external doors and windows of the buildings were boarded up, and loopholes were cut in the walls to shoot through. All this was accomplished in about 4 hours. Then, about 100 of the soldiers, a unit of cavalry, decided against pleas and orders to get on their horses and leave. That left about 150 men to defend the compound. These remaining men then built another wall out of stout wooden biscuit crates inside the compound, making a smaller bastion inside their fort. They planned to cram inside it if it turned out that they couldn't hold the larger perimeter. They were armed with the Martini Henry Mark II rifle, a single-shot, breech-loading weapon with an effective range of about 1,800 yards. Since the outpost was a supply depot, they had a decent supply of ammunition, 20,000 rounds. But when you stop to think, that's still only 5 bullets for every attacking Zulu warrior. The riflemen would need to be careful with their targets. The Mark II rifle also had a socket for a bayonet, which would turn out to be important. The Zulus arrived at 4:20 in the afternoon and immediately began sending in waves of attackers. The British soldiers started firing when the enemy got within 500 yards. Dozens of them were mowed down with each volley, but the Zulus had men to spare. Soon, they made it to the base of the wall of burlap bags. They were unable, however, to reach the British soldiers 9 feet above them, but they tried anyway, grasping at bayonets or climbing on the bodies of their comrades, the living, the dying, and the dead. Finally, they gave up and retreated. In the meantime, a group of Zulus with rifles had taken up perches on a nearby hill and had begun sniping at the defenders. Fortunately, they were inexperienced marksmen, but they kept up a steady rate of fire throughout the day, harassing the defenders and eventually killing five of them. The Zulus repeated their charges, hitting various sides of the walls and washing up against them like waves on oceanside rocks. The defenders were able to make great use of the principle of interior lines, leaving fewer men on less beleaguered parts of the perimeter and rushing extra riflemen to the parts being attacked. Meanwhile, some of the walking wounded distributed ammunition from the center of the compound, and the chief surgeon directed triage and first aid in the hospital. After an hour and a half of such attacks, it became apparent that the hospital was no longer viable for defense. The Zulus were able to grab the rifle barrels protruding through the loopholes and even shoot through the holes into the hospital with their own rifles. A number of brave defenders tried to hold out, but eventually the Zulus began to smash their way into the front rooms of the building. The only way out for the beleaguered hospital defenders was through three interior walls and then out a window at the back of the hospital. While some of the infantrymen used rifles and bayonets to fight off the Zulu intruders, a soldier named John Williams wielded a pickaxe for the tedious, nail-bitingly slow process of knocking holes in the walls, one at a time, large enough to crawl through and drag hospital patients through. He did just that, three times in succession, allowing himself and all but two of the hospital patients and defenders to escape out a back window, across the compound, and into the smaller bastion. The last hole alone took Williams 50 minutes to make with his pickaxe, and this while the Zulus continued their assault and while the hospital roof was burning above them. This amazing combination of heroic, stubborn defense and demolition successfully rescued all but two of the 11 hospital patients. Four of the hospital's defenders died in this valiant holdout and rescue, but the larger battle was far from over. As darkness fell over the battlefield, the Zulus continued and even intensified their attacks. The exhausted defenders continued their efforts. Fortunately, the burning hospital roof gave off some light, making it more possible to pick out targets in the darkness. The attacks finally slowed at about midnight and broke off altogether by about 2 a.m. The Zulu snipers on the hill, however, maintained their harassing potshots until shortly before dawn. When the sun did rise, the Zulus were gone. As the morning progressed, the exhausted soldiers had two more scares. At 7 a.m., a regiment of Zulus appeared on the horizon. The British wearily stumbled back to their cornbag walls, but the enemy force, which had engaged in its own battles against other British the day before, were also tired, hungry, in enemy country, and many of them were wounded. They looked at the British, who looked back, and then they left. Then at 8 a.m., the soldiers were ordered to leave their breakfast and again man the defenses when yet another approaching force was spotted. But they then sagged in relief upon seeing that it was a British relief column. After 10 arduous hours of nearly continuous fighting, 14 of the 150 defenders were dead, and two more would die of their wounds. Of the 20,000 rounds of ammunition they began with, only 900 remained. Brilliant use of the principle of interior lines by inexperienced junior officers, along with the Mark II rifle and brave British soldiers, had resulted in one of the most profoundly astonishing feats in military history. The soldiers on both sides of this battle displayed exemplary bravery, as the infantry grunt often does, despite whatever political maneuvering and chicanery put them into the situation in the first place. The highest honor in the British military tradition is the Victoria Cross, roughly equivalent to our Congressional Medal of Honor. 11 Victoria Crosses were awarded to members of this improvised mix of brave defenders from the Battle of Rorke's Drift. That says more than any poor words from me can express. Next episode, I'll tie the principle of interior lines to a number of parallel concepts in the martial arts. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this series of stories of how military logic, combined with skill and bravery, illustrates my point about the important principle of interior lines. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.